Hey everyone, it's Noah, and welcome back to this week's episode of Peace, Police, and Everything in Between. Towards the end of August, I sat down on Zoom with White Plains Police Chief Joseph Castelli to discuss everything that's been happening in recent months. We talked about his perspective as a certified police instructor and looked at the role implicit bias training, de-escalation tactics, and other techniques play in policing. We also touched on police budgeting, the Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter movements, and recent legislation passed in Albany. And perhaps the most critical part of our conversation was about the horrible police shooting of Mr. Kenneth Chamberlain, a 68-year-old Black Marine veteran whose life was taken at the hands of the White Plains Police in 2011. I spoke for almost 90 minutes with Chief Castelli, so what you're about to hear is the best 50 minutes of our conversation. It's an incredibly packed episode, but every minute is worth listening to. So I hope that, like me, you can learn and grow from this episode of Peace, Police, and Everything in Between. I'm so excited to welcome our guest today, White Plains Police Chief Joseph Castelli. Chief Castelli has been with the WPPD for nearly 30 years. He's served in all sorts of positions in his time, from DARE officer to detective to head of the Criminal Investigations Unit, and now serving as the White Plains Police Chief. He oversees a department with 200 officers and a $40 million budget. Chief Castelli, I'm really excited to dive into these issues with you, and thank you so much for taking the time to be here today.
Again, thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I do think this is a very worthwhile endeavor, especially now.
I want to talk a little bit about the fact that in addition to everything you've done with the WPPD, you're also a certified police instructor. And so recently there's been a lot of public scrutiny over police training, especially about de-escalation techniques, or what some might say there's a lack of teaching of these tactics. And many point to this lack of de-escalation training as a primary cause of police brutality. I'm curious, as a police instructor, do you find the tactics you teach, the techniques, to be flawed?
Well, no, I don't necessarily think they're flawed. I mean, and we're talking about White Plains. I can't really speak to any other department, you know, maybe in general, Westchester County. Certainly training, I do come from a training background. I was a field training officer. I was a liaison with the recruit class. I do a lot of work at the academy. And without training, I don't think we have anything. So I do think training is extremely important. A lot of the stuff, and I'm sure maybe we'll get into it a little later in this, going around the country, from my eye, has a little bit more to do with training and lack thereof than some of the other, monikers that are being placed on why cops are doing things. But, de-escalation, it's not, and it's certainly not just something where it's a block where we're going to talk about de-escalation and then we move on to do something else. It is like a lot of things, like a lot of our fairness in policing and de-escalation, it's kind of woven into the training. So when we do firearms, part of firearms is the de-escalation part. You know, situational awareness, understanding what you're looking at and what you can do to make it safer for everybody, even though you may be in a situation where the firearm may be necessary. But, I mean, that's not that it's extreme, but that is kind of one end of the spectrum. 99.9% of the time, we are dealing with people in less than that type of situation. And it comes down to being able to talk to people, being able to understand what's going on and then take the step. So communication, we try to that talking to people, understanding the body language, things like that. When we do traffic stops, we assess how the cop is, when we do the training, how the police officer is dealing with that person. You know, are they getting their point across? Are they explaining why the stop was made? We put them in various situations. So, it is extremely important. The problem is, in the best of worlds, we would do 60% of training and 40% of police work, but it doesn't work out that way. So we have a good training program here in White Plains. I do believe that. But certainly, we could always do more. But so de-escalation, although there's a specific maybe block of training that talks specifically about that, it's woven into all the other training that we do. It can't be, it has no impact. I don't know, a minimal impact if you just talk about it alone. You have to deal with the various situations that we will come across from just saying hello to somebody, you know. Again, part of the problem is when police are dealing with other people, it's usually not their best moment. You know, when they call us, something's wrong, or if we have to engage somebody, sometimes it's because there's some issue going on. So we are very aware of that, you know, and we understand that people are in, you know, some type of potential agitated or other state. People are generally not comfortable around the police anyway. You know, if I got pulled over, I would still get butterflies in my stomach just from being pulled over. It has nothing to do with, and I've been a police officer for 30 years. It's a natural reaction. So we do understand that.
So let's talk a little bit about being pulled over by the police. There's also been a great deal of scrutiny recently over racial profiling. And in many cases, there's been a noticeable lack of implicit bias training within various police forces all over the country. And so I'm wondering if White Plains police officers are required to go through this type of training before they go out into the field.
They implemented it in the Westchester County Police Academy, I think a couple of years ago, where they have I don't know if it's called implicit bias, but there's various names that some of this training comes under now. But they do have a program for newer cops in the academy. We use in White Plains it's called Fairness in Policing, FIP. It is an implicit bias training. Several of us about 4 or 5 years ago went to this training, myself being one of them, and we trained all our supervisors during supervisors in service training, and then we went through the whole department in 2017 and did that training. When the recruits come out of the academy, we have an in-house academy. They get more of the implicit bias. We have done crash training, which is, is it the movie Crash? I can't remember. I think it's the movie is named Crash. But if you ever seen the movie, it has a lot of, it highlights a lot of the realities of, implicit bias and some of the misconceptions about implicit bias and or the way people interact with each other. We've done procedural justice during our in-service training, so that way, you know, part of it is to understand, you know, we understand why we're doing what we're doing as police officers. Sometimes it's important, a lot of times it's important for us to understand why people may react the way they react, so we can hopefully look to allay their fears. And again, now we're talking back to de-escalation a little bit. So when I say it's all interwoven, that's part of it. But we do implicit bias training. We put that in all our various trainings too. We just don't set it aside. You know, we look at it from all different aspects, as well as, you know, we have bosses who in real time are kind of assessing how our officers are handling things to make sure that that's not an issue. And if it is, that, you know, we look to address it. So yeah, we've been, we've had it officially for 4 years, some form every year when we have our training. We do some type of procedural justice or fairness in policing training. Again, this year we've been a little decimated with COVID, so our training program, you know, getting people together, we're behind the eight ball on that one, but we have plans for the beginning of 2021.
So I know this is probably a hard metric to judge, but has there been a visible effect of the implicit bias training in White Plains? And what if you've seen anything, has the fairness and justice training looked like?
Well, you know, you're right. I do think that it is hard to, well, I don't know if it's necessarily hard to see the impact. I think that our one of the ways you could look at one of the metrics maybe would be complaints. And we do not get very many complaints, certainly about racial profiling or racial bias. You know, like any other department, we may get complaints about rudeness or that things weren't explained to them. We have very few serious allegations. But it is right. I mean, you know, part of the training is not to, and to do the training right is not to necessarily force a concept on somebody, because I don't think will work. But the thing is just to get everybody to think. You know, again, implicit means, you know, it's unconscious. You're not even realizing you're having an effect, or you're acting in a certain way. It's kind of, you know, in the deeper recesses of the brain. Our training tries to make sure that cops are aware that this is a real thing, and try to bring it to the forefront, and be conscious of what they're doing, and to be aware of the potential effect that it may have. And I'm not even talking about serious, let's say, use of force situations. Again, there's so much more interaction that can be people can be affected by, you know, just in the way an officer approaches a crowd, who they approach first, who they talk to first, you know, the things like that. I mean, it's so much. There's a lot more complexity than just, you know, racial bias and implicit bias in the things that we're seeing in the news when, you know, when it's ultra serious.
So I want to switch gears a little bit here. Recently, Governor Cuomo has come out in support of a lot of legislative measures. The New York State Legislature has repealed a law called 50A, which had kept police records confidential. The legislature also passed a ban on chokeholds. And are these changes going to impact the way that officers operate in the WPPD, or were these things that your officers already did in the field?
I'll talk about the chokehold first, because that's an easy one. We never had anything specific in our regulations about a chokehold, but when the Eric Garner incident happened down in the city, we looked at it and we banned chokeholds. And I think that's a good that's obviously what police departments should do. You know, there was a situation, it was a bad situation. Any police department should have to look at what they're doing to see, you know, if that happened here, how would we stand under the light? But to me, what's even more important than that is not just that, okay, we didn't have a rule and we made one, so that is good. But what gives it better perspective and hopefully better understanding is that, again, I've been here 30 years, so maybe 4 or 5 years ago was the Eric Garner thing. We never trained in chokeholds. We never used chokeholds. It just wasn't anything we did anyway. So to give understanding and a perspective, it's not it, we put it in our rules and regulations as a precautionary thing, but not as a need to diminish behavior that we had previously thought was okay. We weren't doing it to begin with. To me, I think that's important. You know, the 58 thing is as a police chief and as a police officer, it's always concerning. You know, I don't think anybody, and certainly me, I don't have a problem necessarily with a letting people know if officers were disciplined for poor behavior. But when you throw in the allegations, the unsubstantiated, you know, the unfounded claims that have to be put in there. In a larger sense, like maybe I understand that maybe that might paint the picture, but you know, there is the job we do. We're not gonna make everybody happy, and people making complaints a lot of times is you know, their unhappiness, and it's probably not the right word, but just the way things were turned out. The fact that that might be able to be used to undermine a good officer is concerning. You know, it's the law. There's a lot of legal stuff going on right now before that's final and done with. But if it is, you know, we're prepared to release everything. And in the long run, in White Plains, I don't think that there's too much that we have to be worried about. I think that we are a professional department, and concerning is a matter of principle, like anybody else would like their, you know, some of their personal info protected, or allegations. If somebody made an allegation that wasn't true about you, and yet it went out as fact to the public, that would be fair. So that's where the concerns come from. But really, you know, and as I said, in the long run, I don't think that the White Plains Police Department has too much to worry about, other than it's a wieldy, unwieldy, I guess is the word, process if people start asking for large amounts of data. But if we have, you know, when the time comes, and I'm sure that the courts are going to decide that everything should be released, we're prepared to
right.
deal with it professionally.
Yeah. And so I, you know, I'm curious, because sometimes with sealed records, what happens, like we saw with the officer that killed George Floyd, he had a long history of offenses. But if there's sealed records and a lack of communication between precincts, would a place like the White Plains Police Department be aware about a candidate and their previous history, even if these records had been sealed before 50A was repealed? And like, how would you ensure that you're hiring people who aren't going to cause harm to the community?
So, you know, White Plains has one precinct, so to speak. So it's not called, it's just headquarters. One place, 200 cops. What I can tell you is that everybody knows everybody. You know, there's no hiding in the shadows. You know, if somebody is acting in a way that is unprofessional, they don't get hidden. I think there's a lot of peer pressure. Even if it's for self-preservation, no cop wants another cop to get them in trouble. But more than that, it's more of a, almost like a training. Some people, for various reasons, think that there's a way cops behave. And I think a lot of the cops here police their own, so to speak, in terms of showing them the way to handle things properly and the way to act. Number two, the hiring process is pretty good. I used to be a part of it. So, you know, we have a background check, and we don't take too many transfers. We do take some, but, you know, the Minneapolis thing, and certainly before we get to that, there's nobody that even comes close to Minneapolis in some of these larger areas. There's not a cop here that has multiple complaints against them. And certainly we I don't think we have any presently that have serious complaints. Certainly, you know, well, I guess use of force, or unauthorized use of force could be, is definitely a serious issue. But we have those, but none substantiated. So the Chauvin, or I hate even saying the guy's name, who was the Minneapolis cop, the fact that he had 13 complaints and then had like two or three rookie officers with him is crazy to me. Why would that guy be the one you want to put new cops with? And then you look what happened. You know, I mean, obviously for the Floyd and his family, a horrible thing, but just a horrible situation all the way around. So yeah, I mean, there's nowhere really to hide here. And the cops that we do transfer come off our list. So we're doing background checks. There's not a whole lot of that. Different parts of the country have different ways of doing things. And different parts of the country, there's way more movement in departments. If somebody here left this department and they were a bad apple, let's say, I think many of the other departments would know that, especially if they sought employment somewhere else. So yeah, it's something we keep an eye on, but it's not I don't think the dynamics are the same as it is in other places, you know, using Minneapolis as an example.
So jumping off that, you just mentioned that there are some unfounded use of force allegations in your department. And I'm wondering, what is the White Plains Police Department policy and protocol for addressing these allegations? And how do you determine if they're unfounded or if there is merit to them?
So, when it comes to our officers do a response to resistance form, and it's a use of force form. So it's almost certainly any time anybody is injured. A police officer is injured, a suspect is injured, a bystander is injured. At times, any time if we were to use a taser, if we were used to some other weapon, the use of force form must be used. Anytime we display our firearm, that just means just taking it out of the holster in public. Whether we point it at somebody or not, we're doing a use of force form, a response to resistance form. And then that gets, I see all of them and I read all of them. And then I have a professional standards who then reviews it. And we also have a panel of captains that would review any that we had questions about. And again, I'm not making, I'm proud of this, but we do not have too many of those that come into question. And when it does, and again, the ones I have read, some of it would be training. You know what I mean? If we're looking at something and the way it's documented, and there's a better way to do it, a safer way, then we look to tweak that. We have body cameras now. We've had body cameras for a long time. Those things are great. We used to get a lot of complaints about unnecessary force. And now that we have body cameras, those, we have the ability at some point to sit down with a person making the complaint, if they have representation, show them the video of what happened. And almost all of them are settled right there when the people see exactly what happened and what the police did and didn't do and how any potential injuries may have happened. And you'll believe it or not, we'll get several complaints of use of force when there are no injuries whatsoever. We're aware of it. We take it very seriously. We certainly don't want to be seen as a police department that is heavy-handed. We want to be seen as a police department that is, knows how to handle bad situations, but knows how to handle them safely and professionally and with everybody's safety in mind, not just the cop's safety.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment with more of Peace, Police, and everything in between. So I want to talk about a tragedy that happened here in White Plains in 2011. A man named Kenneth Chamberlain accidentally triggered his Life Aid medical alert necklace. He was a 68-year-old Marine veteran, and he was black. And the White Plains police came to his home after receiving a message from his Life Aid necklace, and they demanded that he open his front door. And it was reported that the police used a racial slur. Chamberlain repeatedly said he did not need help, but the police broke down his door anyways. And at that point, all four officers reported that Mr. Chamberlain was holding a knife, and he was tasered and then fatally shot. So this was a tragedy, and I want to ask you, I know you weren't chief at this time, but this was an extreme example of excessive force. How would this go about being addressed? I know there was camera footage and audio footage, and I don't know if you would have treated it differently, but had you been chief at the time, how would you have addressed and approached this?
Well, and again, it absolutely any time the police take a life, it's a tragedy. This was the description, and again, I think that part of a very small part of this has been reopened in federal court. So I don't know how much. I'd love to be able to give you 100% of my take on it. I'm going to give you as much as possible. What your description of it is accurate or factual, but there's way more involved there. You know what I mean? And sometimes it's hard to to get into that. And in talking about it, I don't want to minimize the seriousness of it and what happened. So, you know, when you talk about, you know, there was an activation from a medic alert, and we did respond. You know, Mr. Chamberlain was in some type of crisis. It wasn't a normal situation. So in terms of demanding we open the door, you know, when we have those situations, we would like to engage the person to try to make some type of assessment, you know, but face to face. You know, there were some other circumstances and aspects that I probably can't go into right now. And it is unfortunate 10 years later. The racial epithet that my understanding was alleged to be made was not toward him with the officers at the door. There was another officer trying to draw his attention from a bedroom window. And the officer made a comment that it, on the tape, if it is the racial epithet was inappropriate, but wasn't necessarily directed toward Mr. Chamberlain in a derogatory sense. I wish I could be more clear on that. And just so you know, and it wasn't that we got there, demanded to be let in, broke the door down, and that's the way it went. We were at his door for a long time, over, I think, somewhere close to an hour, if not just under, just over, trying to talk to him, trying to get him to open the door. He was, when the door was, and again, we didn't necessarily break it down. It was controlled. You know, the way the description of things are is very impactful. And the image of cops breaking down a door, I get it. You know, it's like a stormtrooper or something. So the door was taken down to get in. And Mr. Chamberlain did have a knife. He was, a taser was used. And it was ineffective. One of the, if I have to get into the, but one of the prongs, I believe, hit the metal door, not making a contact. So that was ineffective. We used beanbag rounds, which are, you know, again, kind of beanbag shot out of a weapon to kind of knock you, the wind out of you if you hit them in the solar plexus area or the legs. He was struck twice with beanbags, but immediately got up. And at that point, an officer had entered kind of the threshold, and Mr. Chamberlain was very close to him, was immediately back up with a knife in his hand, and the officer, the one officer who was, who had his weapon drawn, determined that this was a life-threatening situation for the other officer, and he took action, which unfortunately resulted in Mr. Chamberlain's death. So, you know, when we look back at these things and a lot of the stuff that happens, we forget that some decisions are made in a split second. The nature of what's going on, not only cops, but I'm sure there's other people in other circumstances would have to make split second decisions. And then we have an eternity to Monday morning quarterback, which in a way we should do to make sure we are doing it right and there weren't any things longer. But so whether the procedures were factual, done correct, but certainly when it turns out that way, we have to look at it as what could we have done differently. So, you know, we the mental health team that I talked about prior is part of that. A little bit more training. We're not, you know, we can't train cops to be certified clinical workers, but we try to give them as much more awareness training to provide time and options for what's going on.
I have a couple of follow-up questions, but yeah. You spoke about it as though you were there. Were you there?
I was. I had just made promoted to captain the week earlier of patrol, and it's one of those things that you remember forever. It was a Saturday. So I was a captain for five days, and I got a call that said we have a situation, and it was early in the morning. I put my phone on my chest because, for 20 years of being a police officer, this isn't the first time something like this has happened, and every single time the resolution has been positive. So when I got the call, the second call that there had been shots fired and that Mr. Chamberlain was struck, it was a shock. And I went down there. So I was there immediately after. I wasn't involved in any of the investigative part of it, but being a captain, obviously it was something that was first and foremost in anything that we were doing going forward. And again, just at least to sum up my end of it, I don't want anybody to think that it's just a cavalier thing that like the movies, like there's a shooting and everybody goes on. You know, the officers were presented to a grand jury. The grand jury, which decides whether a crime was committed, said a crime was not committed. It went federally, civil rights violations. The federal courts decided that there were no civil rights violations. There was an appeal. I believe the appeal was lost. We had an independent person come in to assess what happened, and our rules and regulations and procedures at the time made some certainly some recommendations, but certainly never didn't found anything egregious that we were doing anything that caused the situation other than that we were police and that we were there. Again, I'm not trying to take away anything from what happened to Mr. Chamberlain and his family, but there was a process, and we definitely learned from it. We continue to learn from it.
I'd be curious, is the officer who shot Mr. Chamberlain, Anthony Corelli, is he still on with the White Plains Police?
No, he's not.
He's not. And was that a result of this killing?
I'm not sure if I have it exactly right, but he either retired or because he couldn't come back to work was fired. Just because he couldn't come back to work. So when you talk about some of the other stuff, and again, I'm not trying to diminish anything, but many lives were affected by that incident. You know, it's not an easy thing you take somebody's life. So, but understandable, nobody's more affected than the Chamberlain family.
And so I want to go back to the beginning of our conversation. We talked about, you're a certified police instructor. I don't know if you do hypotheticals, but if this situation were to arise, it's a medical alert, the police broke down the door, they reported to see a knife 6 or 7 feet away, would this warrant the use of lethal force or a firearm?
Well, standard training, yeah. I mean, we do train in things like that. And, somebody with a knife in their hand, I don't want any misconceptions that it's not a danger. I would love to give practical demonstrations, but somebody 6 or 7 feet away from you with a knife, if you actually put in a scenario like that, would be concerning to anybody. And I don't even know if it was that much. I mean, if trust me, to me, 6 or 7 feet, it doesn't matter if it was 3 feet, 4, 6 or 7, it's called one step and you're into somebody. So it's, police work is not pretty sometimes. I wish it was easier. I wish it was something that, in a safer environment. We do have that now. We have facsimile machines. We have training where we run through scenarios that people can maybe experience it by being safe. It would offer a better understanding to what law enforcement situations that they face and the options and the decisions they have to make in a split second.
And so I know we spent a lot of time on this. I just have one more.
Okay.
I want to focus. Yeah. We spoke before about how you've had social workers come and are working more. Why was it that a police, uh, a, I think it was two or four police responded to this life aid medical alert as opposed to a health professional or someone. Do you think that that is the right scenario for a police officer to be responding to?
Well, I know that that's some of the talk that's going around today, and I do think that there may be circumstances where a health professional might be the person to respond there. But 10 years ago, standard police practice, and again, I don't know if everybody responded at once. Once you go on a call for aid or something, and it turns into something else, it's standard practice to call for backup, especially if the person is evincing some type of agitated state, refusing to answer the door, whatever it was. I'm not speaking about specifics of the Chamberlain thing, but it was a process. It wasn't it wasn't a six or eight cops showing up all at once to bust down a door. I know that sometimes the story over 10 years can turn into something else, but the truth is slightly different. And again, I wish I could get into a little bit more of the nitty gritty of that to maybe have some understanding. Maybe people won't. They would still see it as being wrong. It's just not something that I don't think I can go into right now while there's still a very small part of this in litigation. But part of what we learned is, I will be very honest with you. I don't know. You're asking me, do I think a social worker would be the right person? You might want to ask a social worker if they want to go on a call where a person has a knife that they're wielding in their hand without the police. I'm not trying to be provocative, but I do think that the combination of our police, our mental health outreach team, which is a couple of detectives in soft clothing, meaning we're not in uniform, we don't look like cops, and a social worker has had many, many beneficial outcomes. And that's, if we could expand on that, that would be great. So part of the evolution is that was not uncommon back then. And whether the Chamberlain incident happened or not, I think that this mental health outreach, at least part of the way we do it, would have been a natural progression as to how police handle work and go on these things. So I do think that there's a need for police to go on these things. Do they need to go on all of them? Maybe not, but it's hard to discern that right off the bat. I look at it as an error on the side of caution. If we're not needed, we can back off. I also understand the other side. We can agitate things. People don't like to see us. They get nervous. They get worried, especially somebody who's in crisis. So we're aware of it. We try to take everything into effect, and we push or we back off as the need. And again, now we're talking a little bit about the escalation again. As I said, it's woven into everything.
So I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk a little bit more about White Plains. I know we've been talking, but about your department specifically, there's about 200 officers and 20 civilians in your department. You have a $40 million budget. That's a lot. Do you think that all of these officers, all of this money, all of these resources are required to keep White Plains safe?
Well, as much as the budget is, I don't have a whole lot of control over it. It does seem like a lot, absolutely. I wish I could give you something to compare to. But if you took a like-size city and dynamics of a city, and they had a half of our budget or whatever, and you have to look at what that does. Now, White Plains, I don't live here, but I'm very proud of the city. I think it's one of the safest sizes of city in the country. You can look at around here, other areas, and I'm not trying to put any other departments to shame, but Newburgh and Poughkeepsie and even more locally Mount Vernon and some smaller towns out on Long Island with comparable size demographics and number of people, and they have way higher crime rates. So you know, we're asked to do a lot, you know, the police department. So when you're talking about social stuff, I mean, in my career, I have fixed toilets, I have unclogged drains, I have moved TVs. So when you talk about a service-oriented police department, it does take bodies. You know, we are about 60,000 people, and during the day, there's a massive influx. So a lot of our manpower used to be, or staffing, would be geared toward the 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. time. And that's why our department may seem somewhat large compared to others. You know, when I first came on, any time of the week, any day of the week after 6 or 7 o'clock, the city went to bed. For any of you, I know you guys are still a little bit younger, but you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Mr. Stockers are laughing, as you know, it's a hopping town, and you know, it requires policing to allow people to come and enjoy themselves and be safe. So, you know, listen, I'm the boss. What I say, should we redirect funds? I'm always going to say no. But certainly, if that decision was made, there would have to be some adjustment in the services that we can provide.
So before we finish up, I just want to talk for a few minutes about the various movements that have sprung up and misconceptions about them. Many respond to Black Lives Matter by saying Blue Lives Matter, and many respond to Blue Lives Matter by saying Black Lives Matter. And so do you think these two movements should be seen as opposite and contradicting one another, or is there some way to bridge the gap between them?
Well, you know, I don't think that, you know, if you wanted to ask me my personal opinion, you know, I was raised to believe that all lives matter. I don't mean that in a hashtaggy type of way. I mean that I truly was brought up, you know, that it is the humanity, you know, a person matters. So, you know, the Black Lives Matter, the ideal of it, I certainly think is worthwhile. I mean, it's understandable. Meaning, if you're a group that feels you're being persecuted or treated unfairly in some way, certainly you're gonna have concern for that. You know, the Blue Lives Matter is you know, it's like anything else. You know, if you're a member of a group, you have pride. You have an affinity toward that group, and when they're under attack, you want to stick up for yourselves also. You know, like just like if you were like a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout, and you're proud of that, and it came under fire, you might want to do something. If you know, doctors have associations, lawyers have associations that bind them together, just like law enforcement does. So I would love to think that there should be a common connection between the two, you know, because, you know, I do think that cops care, you know, not about the color and what's happening to who. But I mean, you look at what's going around this country. I mean, you know, little kids, not little white kids or little other kids, little kids, that doesn't matter to us. And certainly not to me personally, that are getting shot and killed. And it's heartbreaking. Why should a kid in a stroller get shot? A 4-year-old here in their bed, you know, it's crazy. It doesn't matter where they're from or their socioeconomic. They're little kids. They should have an opportunity to become big kids and adults and have a life. And now they're no more. Forget about the trauma and the devastation to the family. So, you know, the groups are what they are. You know what I mean? It is what you make of it. I think, you know, When the political angles get pushed on it or overridden on it, I think the problems can come in there. But the essence of it and what some people are trying to do, I think it's certainly a good thing from all these groups, as long as your motives and what you want is a positive outcome.
We're going to take another quick break right here, but we'll be back in a moment with more of Chief Costello. Before we play Chief Castelli's final remarks, we just want to share one other thing. This episode was recorded on August 25th, and 2 days before that,
Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old African-American man living in Kenosha, Wisconsin, was shot point-blank by the police 7 times in the back. He miraculously survived, but he was paralyzed from the shooting. And so when we recorded this episode, the police had not yet issued a report, and the details were not yet known of the shooting. But there was video footage from bystanders that had been released and that had been viewed. Here's what Chief Castelli had to say.
What I tell my own kids is have a little bit better perspective of the things that you're seeing on TV. You know, while people are condemning it, the next sentence is awaiting a full investigation. So until you have all the facts, sometimes, you know, what is it? I can't remember. A rumor goes around the world as quick as it takes for a fact to put a shoes on or something like that. So if that's unfortunate. But, you know, I just tell them, have some perspective. Don't buy into the immediacy of the news and the social media. It's not, everything is not always what it appears to be. And that's for everything, not just the police stuff, but, you know, the Wisconsin thing is, you know, I just looking at what I saw, you know, would it have been great for them to tackle this guy? Just if you know that there's nothing, I don't know if there's anything in his hand. I heard there might have been a knife. I don't know the prequel to that video. He did seem agitated. The one thing I do know is I don't want him in that car. I don't know. That's an unknown. What I do know is I got a guy here. If you tackle him and nothing happened, maybe he gets bumps and bruises in you. But to say, oh, this is a racial incident, I think it was training and, without a doubt, fear. That cop was not a racist. I'm just my person. Was not a racist. He was afraid that that guy was going to grab something in the car, probably a gun, and then what do you do? And they react. To me, that is all about training. You know, could there be bias, implicit bias? I can't say no, because you know, I don't know anything that well, but from my eye and my experience, that they allowed that situation to go in a way that it they could have controlled better. Just a lot going on. I don't get a chance to talk about this in an honest way too much. I'm going to be honest with you. You know, people don't want to hear it. So I when I tell you I appreciate this, I truly do. Even if I don't expect you to agree and like everything that I said.
No, I mean that's the exact point of this podcast, to foster civil discourse, even if we disagree on certain matters. Chief Castelli, I want to give you, on a final note, a minute to make a pitch to the people of White Plains, many of whom have become quite distrustful or fearful of the police. What would you say to those who believe that law enforcement and the police institution do more harm than good?
Well, you know, and I'm not a big stat guy, because, you know, you can, I know a little bit enough that you can take any bunch of numbers and make it say what you want. You know, if you looked at the interactions that police have on a daily basis, forget about globally, just nationally, and the incidence of bad things happening, is minimal. I'm not trying to trivialize the bad things that are happening. I would say educate yourself. You know, I am very proud of White Plains and the job we do. As I said, does everybody make mistakes? Does everybody pull everything off perfectly? No, but we try as hard as possible to do it every single time. So, you know, if you were going to go to another town or another area of the country and be fearful because of what you know specifically about how they operate there, that may be understandable. I talk to people and they say, how many shootings do you think we have in White Plains a year? And you know, we can get any number, you know, and when it's zero, sometimes people go, wow, I didn't know that. That's something you should know. And it's not all about the shootings. It's about the other interactions also, but we're not, you know, we generally, 99% of the time arrest people without incident. Really get to know. Don't listen to what you hear. Don't attach the overall extreme incidents to everything. It's not fair when it's done to other people. It shouldn't be fair when it's done to police departments unless they deserve it. I was on a, I don't know if any of you were on it, but the public forum the other day that the county had where people could talk, were any of you listening on that? And, a lot of young people, and a lot of young people were very dissatisfied with the police department. I have three kids, two in their 20s and one is 18 years old. So I understand a lot of it, but some of the comments about how they didn't like the police and how distrustful of it was very painful to listen to. I tried my whole life to represent in a good way, and not only me but everybody I work with, and to hear that we're having a negative impact on young people is I still can't wrap my head around it. Like, how do we change that? So one of the ways I would say is to try to get to know your police department. We have to do more to reach out to, especially the young people, without a doubt. We should have things in place when things like Minneapolis and Wisconsin happen, so we can start talking right away back and forth as opposed to just developing things. So there's work to be done, but I would just say, I know the White Plains Police Department. You don't have to be afraid of them. Hopefully bad guys or bad people are a little bit intimidated by us. That's a good thing. I try to be as involved as possible, not to keep going on, but just to give more perspective. I was at a thing with high school students and somebody from another community group, and they happened to be white, and they said that, and a lot of the students that we were talking to were minorities. And this person said, I don't have to give my kids the talk about driving and when they get stopped. And he went into this thing, and I'm sitting there and I'm shaking my head and I'm going, wow. So, and I'm friends with this person. I like this person a lot. When they were done, I said, I respectfully disagree. I said, I'm coming from it from a different angle because I've been a police officer. All three of my kids have had the talk, and not because I'm worried about bad police. It's because I know what a cop is facing when they walk up to a car at any given time. It's all about the unknown. So the more you do to make that a safer situation, the more you can help the situation, put your hands on the wheel, roll the windows down, turn the lights on. I've said that to my kids, not because I'm worried about them getting shot, but because it's the right thing to do. It's the way to make things go smoother. That's probably not the right way. Now, can I speak toward the fear that other people have? No, but I mean, a lot of it is, if you listen to the police, most of the time things are going to go fine. I don't want that to sound too flip, but I just want people to understand that it's not the experience is not exclusive to certain groups when they feel the need to explain things, so those are kind of things that I try to get out. I hope I'm getting my point across on that point, that, police should not be feared. White Plains police should not be feared, but hopefully police in general should not be feared. They shouldn't be. I do understand the challenges that's going on right now, but they should not be.
Yeah. Well, Chief Caselli, it's been so interesting and important to speak with you today, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me and putting this together. This was fun, and you didn't give me an easy time, so I appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Joseph Castelli is the White Plains Police Chief. He's been with the WPPD for nearly 30 years and has a long-standing relationship with Congregation Kol Ami.
If you have any questions, you can reach out to the WPPD. And thank you again to Chief Castelli for speaking with us today. And stay tuned, everyone. We'll be back soon with more of Peace, Police, and everything in between.